Hello and welcome to another Freshfields Tax Matters podcast. I'm Josh Critchlow with the London Tax Team. In an unusually rowdy House of Commons, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt delivered what will be his last spring budget before a UK general election, widely expected to take place in October. Headline crowd-pleasing measures included a further 2% cut in national insurance for employed and self-employed workers, and an increase to the VAT registration threshold from £85,000 to £90,000 from April this year. With me to analyse the tax policies in this spring budget, I'm delighted to be joined by UK tax experts Jill Gatehouse, Emily Saz, and David Hockey. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
Now, there was some interesting politics in the tax policies announced yesterday, with Chancellor Jeremy Hunt raising revenue using Labour's policy of reforming the non-dom rules and taking that money to fund his tax cuts. So from April 2025, the non-dom regime of taxation is being overhauled and UK resident non-domiciled individuals will no longer be able to elect to be taxed on the remittance basis. But before we get into the weeds, Emily, can you remind listeners what is a UK resident non-dom and how does the remittance basis currently work?
So generally, a UK resident individual will be taxed in the UK on their worldwide income and gains. But if you are a resident in the UK and have sufficient ties to another jurisdiction, for example, if your father was born there, then you can be domiciled outside the UK. Those UK resident non-dom individuals can elect to be taxed on the remittance basis. That means that they will be taxed on their UK income and gains, just as they would if they were UK tax resident, but they will only be taxed on their non-UK income and gains to the extent that they remit the proceeds to the UK. These rules, which were first conceived in order to allow subjects living in the colonies to escape war taxes levied during the reign of King George III, have been a political hot potato in recent years, and there have been various efforts to tighten them up. In particular, from 2008, individuals who have lived in the UK long term and wish to claim the remittance basis have needed to pay an annual fee in order to do so. And in 2017, the deemed domicile rules were brought in so that people who had lived in the UK for more than 15 years were deemed to be domiciled here.
So for a long time, we've had this really antiquated concept of domicile, but that's going to be abolished going forward. So how will it work instead?
Well, from the 6th of April 2025, UK resident non-dom individuals will no longer be able to elect to be taxed on the remittance basis. Instead, UK resident non-doms will be subject to tax in the UK on their worldwide income and gains, irrespective of whether they remit those income or gains to the UK. There is, however, a concession which applies when someone first arrives in the UK.
And that's the new four-year foreign income and gains regime?
Yes, that's right. This regime applies to individuals who become tax resident in the UK after they have been tax resident elsewhere for at least 10 years. For the first 4 years of their UK tax residence, they won't pay tax on foreign income and gains arising during those periods and will be able to bring those funds to the UK free from any additional charges. The government presumably felt that they needed to provide for some grace period after people first arrive here. There is, in fact, a seven-year grace period baked into the existing non-dom rules, in the sense that it is only after that seven-year period that an individual needs to start paying a fee in order to be taxed on the remittance basis. At 4 years, this is obviously a shorter period of time, but there is some upside because the individual will be able to remit their foreign income and gains to the UK during those 4 years without triggering UK tax charges.
Okay, got it. So do you think the government views this regime as an incentive for people to come and work in the UK?
Yes, perhaps. It means that an individual who comes to work and live in the UK could realise significant foreign gains in those first 4 years and remit those funds to the UK without them becoming subject to UK tax.
Okay, so that deals with new arrivals to the UK. But what about non-doms who are already here? Are they able to take advantage of this new foreign income and gains regime?
Possibly, yes, if they became UK residents since April 2021. The proposal is that in those circumstances, the four-year clock would start from the date that they became UK resident, so they may still have some time left to take advantage of the regime. And for tax year 25-26, they will pay tax on only 50% of their foreign income rather than 100%.
And for these people claiming the benefit of the non-dom regime today, what happens to their historic income and gains that's currently held offshore? Do they have to hold it offshore forever?
Well, historic income and gains are covered by a couple of transitional measures. Firstly, in relation to accrued gains, non-DOMs will be able to elect to rebase their foreign assets for capital gains tax purposes. So they will only be taxed on any gain arising by reference to the value of the asset as at April 2019.
Okay, so individuals won't suddenly be subject to UK tax charges on gains that they've accrued over a very long period of time. But what about those historic income and gains that have been realised but kept offshore?
Well, non-DOMs are going to be incentivised to repatriate those funds to the UK, where it can be spent and invested. The government are proposing the introduction of a temporary repatriation facility. This will operate just for 2 years, in tax years 25-26 and 26-27. And the idea is that foreign income and gains earned personally by individuals before the rules came into effect can be remitted back into the UK at a reduced rate of tax of 12%.
Okay, so if an individual earned foreign income in this tax year and is holding it offshore, then what they could do is remit it to the UK and only pay 12% instead of perhaps 45 or 20%. But what happens if they don't choose to remit it?
Well, they can continue to hold the foreign income and gains offshore if they choose to do so. But if they later decide to remit those foreign income or gains to the UK after the temporary repatriation facility has closed, then it will be taxed in the UK at normal rates.
Interesting. And presumably some non-DOMs will choose to do that. As an aside, this temporary repatriation facility feels slightly reminiscent of the US Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, when all foreign earnings of US groups were deemed repatriated for US tax purposes, but at preferential rates.
I agree, except the non-DOMs in this case will have the choice of whether to remit and benefit from the preferential rates or keep the money abroad. I think the government is hoping the preferential rates will encourage a good chunk of income and gains to be remitted to the UK and invested here, but without deeming all of it to be remitted, which might scare off some non-DOMs. HMT acknowledged, though, that there are uncertainties as to the potential behavioural response to this change. In the past, some have argued that changing these rules could incentivise non-DOMs to leave the UK altogether. But the government have said that they expect the facility to attract £15 billion of foreign income onshore and to generate more than £1 billion of extra tax. Overall, HMT are expecting to collect up to £2.8 billion of extra tax each year as a result of these changes. We'll just have to wait and see what happens. We're told to expect further updates and draft legislation that will be published later in the year for technical comment. That will cover a number of consequential changes that will need to be made to accommodate these new rules, including in relation to the inheritance tax regime. So watch this space.
And while we're on the topic of taxation for individuals, another thing which caught my eye was the proposed changes to the transfers of assets abroad rules. So before we get into those changes, David, could you remind us how those rules currently work?
So very broadly, the transfer of assets abroad rules are a set of anti-avoidance rules which treat income as arising to a UK resident individual if certain conditions are met. And firstly, the individual has to have transferred assets to a non-resident entity with the aim of reducing the transferor's liability to UK tax. Secondly, as a result of the transfer, income must arise to the transferee entity. And thirdly and finally, the transferor must either have the power to enjoy that income or to receive a capital sum that is connected with the transfer, or alternatively, some other UK resident individual must receive a benefit provided out of assets made available by the transfer.
Okay, thank you. So what's changing?
So the rules currently focus on transfers made by individuals. So they're only engaged where an individual makes a relevant transfer of assets, and it's then that individual to whom income is treated as arising under the rules. However, the government is proposing to introduce new measures which will effectively deem a transfer to be made by an individual for the purposes of the rules if it is made by a close company or a company that would be close if it were UK resident and the individual has a so-called qualifying interest in that company.
So, David, these rules have been on the statute book in some form for almost a century. Is there a particular reason the government's making these changes now?
The background to these changes is really the Supreme Court's decision in Fisher, which was released at the end of last year. And that case concerned the potential application of the rules to minority shareholders and directors in a UK company, which transferred its business to a sister company in Gibraltar. And one of HMRC's arguments in that case was that if the rules required the transfer to be made by an individual in order to apply, in this particular circumstance, the individuals in question could effectively be deemed to be transferors by virtue of their shareholding in the company, which was the legal transferor. One of the points that HMRC had made before the Supreme Court in support of that view was that if the Supreme Court did not agree with that interpretation, then there would be a significant lacuna in the legislation, in the sense that the rules could be circumvented by an individual transferring assets to a UK company, which then immediately transferred them offshore. The Supreme Court rejected HMRC's arguments on this issue, and in its concluding remarks, it noted that if a lacuna did exist, it was for Parliament to correct that rather than the courts. And that's exactly what the government seems to be seeking to do with these measures.
I see. And these rules are notoriously complex. Has the government provided any detail on how the new measures are going to work?
Well, you're right, they are complicated, and the Supreme Court said as much in Fisher. We don't have draft legislation yet, so some of the detail remains unclear. I think one of the key questions that remains to be answered is exactly what will constitute a qualifying interest. So the level of control or financial interest in a transfer or company that an individual needs to have to be within the scope of the rules. Another thing to look out for will be exactly how the rules are implemented. So the government's policy paper published with the budget indicates that the rules will take effect from the 6th of April 2024, but in relation to income arising from that date. And so it's possible that they may apply to transfers that have already taken place prior to them.
Thanks, David. And the arrangements you mentioned in Fisher involved a transfer by a family-owned company. Are the changes only going to be relevant for transactions taking place in that context?
That certainly seems to be the intention. The government's policy paper suggests that the measure will impact only a very small number of UK residents. And similarly, the estimated exchequer impacts are very limited. That said, the definition of close company is very broad, and there are a number of scenarios where a company can be close outside of the family-owned context. So, for example, where a company is ultimately controlled by a large number of individuals who are acting in partnership with one another. So while the other elements of the transfer of assets abroad rules, in particular the tax motive requirements, mean the rules only apply in a very limited number of scenarios, the new measures which the government are introducing may mean that the rules have to be at least considered, if only to be dismissed, on a larger number of commercial asset transfers involving companies.
So far we've covered some major reforms here, but one's really aimed at individuals. There wasn't much in the budget on tax reform for companies, was there?
I think that's right. Although, as usual, energy companies were used as a source of additional revenue to help balance the books. Chancellor Hunt has extended the 35% energy profits levy for another year from 2028 to 2029, with the possibility of the measure ending earlier if oil and gas prices return to historically more normal levels.
Yes, the energy companies have had a run of bad luck in recent fiscal events. On the positive side, the Chancellor noted that we may see some expansion of the full expensing regime to include some allowances for plant and machinery used for leasing, although it doesn't appear that a final decision has been made on that yet. And loosely on the theme of encouraging investment in the UK, there will be an extended £5,000 tax-free ISA allowance for retail investment in UK equities. That seems to me a bit tokenistic, but nonetheless good to see some effort towards reinvigorating the UK's capital markets and investment in UK assets. Jill, what else did we see in this space?
Well, in the asset management sector, I guess other than for those working in that sector who are non-DOMs, there was some good news in the budget in the form of an announcement that the government is going to go ahead with a new form of investment fund called a reserved investor fund aimed at professional and institutional investors. By way of a very high-level summary, perhaps of the sort that would make my regulatory colleagues wince slightly, for UK regulatory purposes, a fund can be authorised or unauthorised. And if it's authorised, it can be marketed to a wider category of investors, but then they're subject to more restrictions on the type of assets it can invest in and the balance between types of investments. An unauthorised fund is generally less restricted in what it can invest in, but that doesn't mean it's completely unregulated. The operation in the UK of even an unauthorised collective investment fund is a regulated activity, and the operator must be authorised by the FCA. But the level of regulation is less than that for an authorised fund. Some years ago, the UK introduced what is known as a COAX, a co-ownership authorised contractual scheme. And this is a contractual form of collective investment arrangement, which is authorised for regulatory purposes. They've apparently been quite attractive to pension funds and insurers, But HMRC have been consulting on whether to introduce what is effectively an unauthorised, so lower cost from a regulatory perspective, version of this, subject to less regulation and available to professional and institutional investors. They've decided to go ahead with this, and we have some indication of how the tax system will apply to such an arrangement.
Thanks, Jill. So what will be the conditions for a fund to be a reserved investor fund, and what will that tax system look like?
Well, it's worth just recognising that the background to many changes in the funds area in recent years is essentially the UK funds industry's need to compete with other popular asset management locations, such as Luxembourg, and also the growth in investment of private capital, so investments other than on listed markets. With that in mind, particularly the jurisdiction point, to encourage UK management, a fund is only going to fall within these RIF rules if the operator is in the UK and therefore a UK authorised person for regulatory purposes. It's also worth noting that whilst we don't have the draft legislation yet, so this detail is very much from the government response to the consultation, it is expected that a RIF will need to have a diverse investor base, satisfying both the non-close and genuine diversity of ownership conditions. That means this type of fund is not going to replace things such as Jersey property unit trusts or apply to joint venture situations that might otherwise constitute alternative investment funds for regulatory purposes. The government suggests that it is expected that RIFs will be particularly attractive for investment in commercial real estate. The reason for this comes down to a technical point relating to the VAT treatment of investment management fees, specifically that fees paid by unauthorised funds are subject to VAT, but real estate funds may have a recovery position. Finally, coming to the actual tax regime, a RIF will be taxed similarly to a COAX, so be transparent for income with a need to report that income to investors so that they can pay tax on it as it arises. It'll be opaque for capital gains. And importantly, given the fact that this will be attractive in the real estate context, treated as a company for SDLT purposes. So transfers of units in a RIF will not be subject to SDLT, even if the fund holds UK real estate. Because a RIF is opaque for CGT purposes, to avoid RIFs being used as a wrapper to avoid UK capital gains tax on UK land, there will be restrictions on the assets a RIF can hold. So either all the investors need to be exempt, such as pension funds, there needs to be no UK land in the fund, or the fund needs to be property rich for UK capital gains tax purposes, so that sales of the units in the fund would be subject to UK capital gains tax on investors both inside and outside the UK. So a positive change for the UK investment management industry in terms of flexibility, but it will remain to be seen how popular it is in practice.
Yeah, the UK government has had a history of innovating on new types of fund structures, but how popular they've really been with the asset management industry, I'm not fully convinced. So we'll have to wait and see what's in store for RIFs. What didn't we see today that we might have been expecting?
Well, frustratingly, we are still awaiting a response from HMRC on their consultation into modernising stamp taxes. We will have a tax administration and maintenance day on the 18th of April, so we can dare to hope that we might see HMRC's response to the consultation then. The stamp policy team have been keeping themselves busy in the meantime, though. They have now legislated to amend the circumstances in which the 1.5% stamp tax charge will apply, which means that on many new listings, it won't be a concern. Although there are a number of conditions that need to be worked through, and on Budget Day, they published some new guidance on that new legislation.
I think there were a few other things that we'd expected or hoped for that we didn't see. So perhaps surprisingly, there was nothing at all in the budget on Pillar 1 or Pillar 2. So we might expect more on that in the future, in particular on the UK's implementation of the undertaxed profits rule, perhaps as part of the tax administration and maintenance day on the 18th of April. Similarly, after a flurry of activity in recent fiscal events, there were no further changes to the research and development regime announced. The government has announced a new expert panel, which will be established to help keep the guidance on those rules up to date, but not with a view to future legislative changes. The government had also previously announced that there would be a 2024 consultation on draft legislation on reforms to the UK's transfer pricing, permanent establishment and diverted profits tax rules. But nothing has been published in the budget, so we'll keep an eye out on the 18th of April again for that. And finally, we're still waiting for an update on the consultation which took place on a new UK corporate redomiciliation regime. There hasn't been a huge amount of movement on those rules in the last 2 years. The government did convene an independent expert panel late last year to explore options for the regime, so may not be one to hold our breath for.
Thank you, David. And thank you again to Jill, Emily and David for joining me for this spring budget discussion. If listeners would like to discuss any of the issues raised in the podcast today, please get in touch with your usual Freshfields contact or any of our podcast speakers. And finally, from me, Josh Critchlow, thanks for listening and goodbye.